Hello, and welcome to episode 159 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Rear Admiral Shepard Smith, the director of the Office of Coast Survey at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, also known as NOAA, located within the Department of Commerce. Rear Admiral Shepard Smith is also a commissioner on the Mississippi River Commission. He's a former assistant scoutmaster, the former commanding officer of a NOAA ship named the Thomas Jefferson, and he's also an awardee of 3 Commerce Bronze Medals and 4 NOAA Corps Commendation Medals throughout the course of his career. Shep, thanks so much for joining us today. How are you?
Thanks, Jordan. I'm doing very well.
Excellent. So the first question I'd like to pose to you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Oh, that's a great question. I chose a life of public service. Mm-hmm. It came sort of naturally out of what I was interested in college, and I was attracted to a career at NOAA because of the really tight tie between science and delivering public value, societal value out of the science that we do and the observations at sea. I've spent most of my career surveying in the oceans and then making that data available for public use, primarily in making the maps of the oceans that everyone uses to navigate on, which contribute to not only economic prosperity but prevention of oil spills and damage to life and property at sea.
So you're creating maps of land underneath the water. So the seabed, is that what you're creating maps of?
Exactly. So traditionally, it's mostly been about the depth, somewhat about the composition. In the very old days, it was about composition because that's how people navigated. They would put a lead line over with a little piece of tallow on it. Mm-hmm. It would pick up a piece of the bottom, mm-hmm. and they could actually look at the color and the texture, mm-hmm. and have an idea because of the maps where they were based on the type of the bottom.
So
we don't navigate that way anymore. Yeah. But that same information is still valuable for habitat mapping, for instance, to understand how the fisheries work on our coastal waters, and how we better manage the ocean resources.
So, is the primary product of your daily work cartography? Is it maps?
That's right. Okay. That's right. And so, twenty years ago, that was all paper. Uh-huh. As today, just in on the oceans, as it is on roads, uh-huh. We do almost everything digitally now. So digital maps are used on dedicated devices or on computers on the bridges of everything from the largest ships to a small sailboat that someone may have a mobile phone on.
So to get a sense of what it is exactly you do, I'd like to take the conversation a little bit to the perspective of your clients, right? So many individuals just living around the United States may not, on a daily basis, have a need for understanding what is under the water 5 miles out off the beach in Maryland or Delaware. But it seems as though you mentioned oil rigs, fisheries, oystermen. Can you take maybe the Coast Guard or tugboats to help people navigate? Can you take a moment and talk about who consumes these maps? Who are your clients, as it were?
So primarily it is people who make their living on the ocean, mm-hmm. whether that's the big shipping companies, mm-hmm. or the fishermen themselves, or the tugboats that are pushing the cargo around the United States. Mm-hmm. As you know, most of the cargo that comes and goes to the United States, it comes by ship. Mm-hmm. And at least it arrives by ship, before it goes into a broader distribution network. Mm-hmm. And so the maps that we create support that infrastructure.
Do these users of the maps pay any kind of user fee since they're disproportionate beneficiaries of these maps, or is it completely a product of federal appropriations?
So the final delivery, that is, if something is printed and given to you, mm-hmm. that's a private enterprise. We create the digital maps. If someone were to want that on paper, we don't print it and give it to you. You pay for the printing and distribution costs. But the surveys and the maintenance of the information, mm-hmm. is done through federal appropriations.
So I'm thinking, so obviously, you know, you've done this for many years, and of course, North America, well, first of all, has North America remained where it is? There's continental shifts, and there's shifts under the water, so maybe it has moved, and I guess there's sandbars changing. Why is it that this is something that needs to be continually refreshed?
It takes a really long time. So we're still, in a sense, doing it for the first time with modern technology. So we've really only had echo sounders since World War II. Mm-hmm. We've only had electronic navigation for the past 20 years or so, 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. So to where it was really easy to find out where you were. And the combination of the also about 20 years we developed the ability to have really high resolution sonars of the seafloor so that we could find the smaller things. I don't know whether you're too young to remember the Queen Elizabeth II grounding in New England, but it was a big cruise ship from the Cunard Lines hit an uncharted rock in the vicinity of Buzzards Bay, Massachusetts. They had diverted from their normal track to take a little bit of a shortcut and went across some areas that looked like it might have been deep enough, but there was a glacial erratic left there from the last ice age that nobody had discovered, and they hit it and did a lot of damage to the ship, an enormous amount of economic damage to their business, and that's one example, and so that was an area that we just simply had not mapped at that resolution where we could see all of those smaller features. Another example in the Delaware Bay in early 2004, the tanker Athos 1 was approaching the dock that they were preparing to unload their oil cargo, and hit an unmapped anchor that had been jettisoned there or lost there, in the not in the channel but sort of in the waterway between the channel and the pier, and caused a $160 million oil spill. At the time, it was the second biggest oil spill after the.
What state was this in?
In Delaware.
In Delaware, so there was an anchor from a ship that was on the ground of. Underwater, so they must have been close to the ground anyway.
So, in order to maximize the value of our built infrastructure, if you will, it's very expensive to dredge a channel, and to so that we try to bring in the biggest ships that we can to the ports, so that they can maximize the cargo and minimize the cost.
Yeah.
And so they were coming in with what they thought was enough margin underneath the keel, but. With that, hard object sticking up off the seafloor, they hit it, hold the ship, and caused a huge oil spill. So those are sort of two examples that I use to describe sort of why the need for ongoing mapping. I'll tell you. I also you mentioned that it was sort of a disproportionate value. Well, actually, most Americans are affected by the shipping industry every day. Certainly, some people work in it, but
from the T-shirt they're wearing from China,
the clothes we're wearing on our backs probably came by ship.
Right,
and those so every American has a stake in the efficient marine transportation system.
So would you say that the primary objective for creating these maps is to help ships avoid underwater objects?
So that was certainly the case in the two examples that I gave, and for deep water traffic and ships, that's essentially a really big part of our business. The other societal value that I often talk about is the value to coastal communities. So I got 76 letters in 3 days last summer. From Massachusetts, and this was a group of people that had sort of gotten together to figure out an economic initiative on the Merrimack River. So the Merrimack River runs from Newburyport up through Salisbury, Haverhill, Massachusetts, and we got letters from Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas, from the mayors of all of the towns along there, from the state representatives.
What were they communicating?
And right down to the to the pizza, to the guy that runs the pizza store.
Pizza store.
So I don't often get letters requesting the services of nautical charting from people who run pizza stores.
Yeah.
So this really did catch our attention.
Uh-huh.
And the story that they told was about their initiatives to turn the cities around and have them sort of more water facing,
huh.
and to use the river that is in their backyard as an economic engine for growth. So this, it's navigable all the way to Haverhill, Massachusetts from the ocean, but it really hadn't been used much for navigation. It was not a recreational area, so there was not very much activity. When they traced it out and figured out why,
mm-hmm.
they realized that people didn't know how to safely operate on the river because there were no charts. In fact, there was a very old chart,
mm-hmm.
and that was not very detailed.
Mm-hmm.
So what they were requesting was a larger scale chart and modern surveys.
So you chart and survey all of America's waterways.
Indeed.
Not just the oceans, but also the lakes and rivers.
So we do. So without getting too bureaucratic about it, we have the coastal areas and the navigable rivers from the coasts.
Hmm.
The Army Corps of Engineers, and this is maybe a good segue into my role on the Mississippi River Commission,
mm-hmm.
the Army Corps of Engineers has a responsibility for navigation on the inland river system, which starts in Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
and drains 41% of the continental United States.
Yeah, because I remember reading about Robert E. Lee really making his mark with the Army Corps of Engineers and diverting the Mississippi River around St. Louis, Missouri. But of course, was NOAA, I guess NOAA didn't exist back then.
NOAA as an agency started in 1970, but my little part of it, the Office of Coast Survey, traces its roots to the Survey of the Coast, which was authorized by President Thomas Jefferson in 1807. We're the oldest scientific agency in the U.S. government.
So why was Robert E. Lee figuring out how to channel the river's forces on the Mississippi instead of your part?
So the Army Corps of Engineers has had public works.
Okay.
So we map things, we don't change them. Engineering is about affecting it and managing it.
Okay.
And so the Army Corps of Engineers has responsibility for the public works and civil works of the United States.
Hmm.
And that's even though it's under DOD sort of by chain of command, it's really a different kind of a different animal,
mm-hmm.
with the Civil Works Department.
So do you do the West Coast too?
Indeed, in Alaska. So my first tour was in Alaska. We had a ship that was based in Seattle, spent our entire field season mapping in Alaska, and those really were first-time surveys up there of any type.
Was it more dangerous for you to do a first-time survey?
There are precautions that we need to take where we're operating in completely uncharted waters,
mm-hmm.
that are a little different than if we're trying to refine remap an area that we have a pretty good idea about.
But clearly, uncharted waters don't mean that human boats have never been there. It just means that no one's taken the time to map what's under the water.
Indeed, and to record it and have their, in a way that can be used for cartography.
Are you also recording where there are oyster shoals or where there may be crabs or fish? Or?
So other parts of NOAA are responsible for fisheries.
Uh-huh.
You can't see directly crabs, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
You can see oysters because they aggregate into sort of an oyster reef.
Yeah.
And so in the Chesapeake Bay, for instance,
mm-hmm.
a lot of our surveys are in partnerships with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources and the National Marine Fisheries Service within NOAA,
mm-hmm.
who have responsibility for fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
And in those cases, we're mapping out places where to seed oysters as well as where natural oyster beds still exist.
Interesting. So, and then what about, you mentioned oil rigs as well. I think you spoke about the deep water horizon. Is that something that you spoke about?
So I was, I can.
Yeah.
I was the commanding officer of the NOAA ship Thomas Jefferson during deep water horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very interesting scientific challenge during that period. Clearly, the highest priority was to stop the oil, was to stop the leak, so it wasn't going to leak anymore. But at the same time, it was a very unique opportunity to some really big scientific questions. How much oil is coming out? And the second one is, and where is it going? What's the ultimate fate of that oil? It was
Why is that your responsibility? Because you're filling really, out.
In a sense, it wasn't. Okay. The federal government didn't have people sort of standing around waiting for a giant oil spill.
Yeah, she just happened to be there.
So we happened to be in the area, and we, you know, and we had a scientifically oriented ship with some relevant equipment that we could use.
To identify where the oil was coming from.
Well, so we could. I don't know. You probably don't remember, but maybe you do. The oil was. Most of it was coming to the surface because oil floats. Some of it was not because it was being dispersed at depth, being a special kind of detergent, essentially, that would break the oil down into little droplets that would then stay at depth.
Yeah.
It was an enormous amount of oil, so the challenge was, where is it going to go, and what effect will it have on the ecosystem wherever it is going to go?
Yeah.
So we were tracing the oil from the source and in the stratified layers at depth. But there was a great deal of public concern about this, and part of my explicit role there was to be a little bit of a public face of science, and to explain what was happening and to produce results that were able to be communicated to the public, who was very concerned about this. So we did a lot of interviews. We did a lot of tours on board, just showing people what we could see about the oil.
So transitioning a little bit to you. Well, first of all, let's just start with your title. You're a rear admiral. So there's two things. I feel like many listeners may be thinking of admirals, and they may think of one of those big hats from the 18th century with a feather in it, commanding a fleet of ships. So, and a rear, we're thinking like behind. So maybe there's some kind of ships doing some fighting, and then the rear admirals in charge of the ships behind the front line in the Navy. Like, what is going on with rear admiral?
So I am a NOAA Corps officer. I'm an officer in the seventh.
Are
and
you
smallest,
in the military?
I am in the seventh and smallest uniformed service. So the NOAA Corps operates the ships and aircraft and serves in other positions of leadership within the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. States back, we're celebrating our 100th anniversary as a uniformed service this year. On May 20th, we will turn 100.
Congratulations!
Thank you. so my title, my rank, follows the traditions of the sea services. And so I'm a rear admiral. Lower half is the first of the flag officer ranks in the sea services. It used to be called Commodore in some still is in some sea
in
services
Navy.
around the world. The Australians still call it a Commodore, for instance.
Huh.
But essentially, it's an executive level position within the uniformed service.
Interesting. So. You command multiple ships.
So my role now is I own the mission, not the operational assets. So the ships themselves do work for me, but they are operated by a different flag officer, whose sole focus is the operation of the ships and aircraft.
So let's get more into the life of Shep here. So you're in college at some point, and then you figure, you know what, I need to become a rear admiral, and I need to do it by mapping the ground under the water.
Yeah, it didn't happen that way exactly. So there's I was a mechanical engineering undergrad at Cornell University.
And at which university?
Cornell.
Okay.
I was when I looked at the job market after I got out, there were, you know, the folks that were hiring were, you know, the sort of military industrial complex or the car industry and I was very interested more in environmental issues, particularly alternative energy, at the time, and so I ran across this advertisement and a little video about the NOAA Corps, and thought that it would be a great way to get my first job under my belt and spend a few years doing something interesting, and then go back to grad school a few years later.
Did you ever make it to grad school?
So I certainly never thought I would last this long in uniform. But it's kept being fun ever since. And in fact, at midway through my career or so, I did get a chance to go to grad school. I got a master's degree in ocean engineering from the University of New Hampshire. That was a brand new program that stood up there. And it's since become the world class, the world leader in ocean mapping.
Which is fun. They only have a few miles of coastline in New Hampshire, right?
Indeed, yeah. I think it's about 12 along the open coast. And it's very well mapped now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would imagine so.
But it's sort of more about the people than it is about the environment around there. And so NOAA sponsors this program and through a grant, and it's become there's a lot of other programs supported as well, and it's really become a coalescing place for ocean mapping technology and research.
Interesting.
In
so
the US.
You had an environment, you had an interest and some academic expertise in engineering, and then you had an interest in renewable energies. Was this during the oil crisis, OPEC time?
So I graduated in 94 or 93 from
college. Much beyond all that, in the 90s. Was renewable energy a big topic of discussion in the early 90s?
Sure. Well, it was a topic of discussion. We were, at the time we envisioned solar photovoltaic, but at the time the energy balance wasn't there. It took more energy to make one solar panel than that solar panel would produce in its lifetime.
Huh.
Wind power certainly was out there, but again, the engineering wasn't
very much in its infancy.
Very much in its infancy, and I think through in the last 20 some years, as we've they're through public subsidies and through some changes in the sort of economic landscape, those technologies have really taken off now, and it's pretty exciting to see.
So as we approach the end of this podcast, I'd like to ask you a final question. I'd like to ask you to reflect upon your years in public service with NOAA and speak about why it is that you found it so rewarding or so important for you to work to create these maps to benefit other people in other industries, to benefit the American people, to benefit the maritime industry, to benefit trade in general, why it is you've done it, and then also add on to that what you hope you will have accomplished, what your legacy will be upon the conclusion, reaching the conclusion of your career.
So interestingly, at about certainly in the first half of my career, it was about getting that work done, getting it work done efficiently, more accurately, the service delivered better. While those things are still primary in my mind, as I sort of reached into the leadership ranks of NOAA, it's been much more about developing the people within my organization that will succeed me and that will carry on the really proud traditions of our 200 year plus old mission for the next 200 years. And I'm continually inspired by the people who are called to public service and called to express it in this way. And so when I go to work every day, it's about creating the environment for their success and for the future of this program.
And that has been Rear Admiral, the Admirable Admiral Shepard Smith, the Director of the Office of Coast Survey at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Commissioner on the Mississippi River Commission, a former commanding officer of the Thomas Jefferson, an awardee of numerous medals, who speaks essentially of his role in carrying on the tradition of the Lewis and Clark expeditions, beginning with President Thomas Jefferson's commission of charting the waters and the land in this newfound nation in the early 19th century. Shep continues the same mission
of trying to protect commerce, protect the public welfare, and make sure that for recreational or commercial purposes, coastal areas and navigable waterways are safe for transport, whether it's through his cartography skills and avoid helping ships to avoid underwater collisions, or helping coastal communities experience economic development around waterways. Shep is committed to developing people within his administration, his agency, in order to perpetuate this mission. And for Shep, the evolution of this unforeseeable career in underwater cartography has been one that really brings great value to the public at large, especially due to the global implications of trade, globalization in the 21st century, where many of the products we consume and use on a daily basis are produced or used elsewhere, enabling oranges to get to us all the times a year, and pineapples fresh and mangoes in the middle of winters on the East Coast. So that is how he advances the public interest, is by making the life as we know it possible today. So, Shep, thank you so much for joining us for today for this episode.
Well, thank you, Jordan. You're an excellent listener.
And for our listeners, this has been episode 159 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. I'll remind you to subscribe at publicinterestpodcast.com, listen on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, Player FM, Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. And should you wish to communicate with Rear Admiral Shepard Smith, please call 240-630-0380, and that voicemail will be conveyed to him. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.